is to give a bit of a survey of some of the history of the subject. So this is something we all know, that this is a hot topic, and it purports to solve a long-standing problem, namely how to find the world volume theory of coincident supermembranes and 11-dimensional M theory. Now we know that this is going to be, it was always supposed to be much harder than the description of D-brains and string theory, because for D-brains we can take the weakly coupled limit, but M theory is inherently strongly coupled, so it's not totally clear a priori what to do. I'll describe some recent ideas on this problem. Okay, so before that, let me just discuss a bit the situation with D-brains. Well, here we know that the dynamics of D-brains is given by a collection of open strings attached to them. So if you consider, for example, the case of coincident N D3 brains, one finds you engage theory in four dimensions, which is maximally supersymmetric. It has N equal 4 supersymmetry. And the idea behind getting from this to a dual gravitational description is to basically to replace the D-brains by the curved metric that they create. And then we find this famous three-brain metric, which is a work product of R6 and R3, 1, whose metric is here. And deep down this throat, we find the ADS5 process 5 metric, whose radius is related to the coupling G squared N of this supernormal theory. So this is in a nutshell how we get ADS5 CFT4 duality in the simplest possible setting. And then if we want to repeat this for ADS4 CFT3, then we have to replace these D3 brains by M2 brains. But it's not clear what replaces these open strings. In that case, we don't have really any strings. I don't want you to miss the seminar.
Here's the corner over here.
I'm not sure it's worth recording what I'm about to say. Okay, so then the idea will be similar. So this part of the metric is extremely similar for the M2 brains. We again get this ADS throat. In that case, it will be ADS 4 process 7. But it's not clear what replaces this picture. There is no weakly coupled description with strings attached. Okay, so this you all know, that for D3 brains, we have a very special theory. It's a superconformal theory, which is just Yang-Mills theory coupled to 6 scalar fields, which can be combined into 3 complex scalars, Z, W, and V. And then there are 4 Bluinos. At the end, we have SU4 R symmetry, in this case, which rotates the 4 supercharges of the theory. And this theory works out to be exactly scale invariant. And this is in agreement with this corresponding geometric symmetry of ADS6. We have so the conformal symmetry is realized geometrically in ADS5. As is obvious from this ADS from the ADS of the parameterization of the space. So this is something that has been sort of in the news for quite a while. You have a nice description, a dual description in the small curvature limit, which turns out to be the large 12 coupling limit of the theory. One can develop some novel expansion in inverse powers of lambda, which sort of complements what we see in small lambda in the gauge theory. Okay, so I would say that this research in ABS5 CFT4 duality has kind of rekindled interest in the maximalist supersymmetric Bordi gauge theory. I mean, if I remember how it was, say, 11 years ago, and I wouldn't say too many people were interested in the subtleties of the dynamics of Penny-Poiseuille supernovas. I mean, people knew that there was S duality, but precisely what happens in this theory at the origin of moduli space, well, people understood that it's not well understood, but there wasn't, you know, in some sense, so much interest in it. But now it's kind of become, in some sense, a solution for many of the world's problems, like ring physics, sure, we can apply it there. So in some sense, this conformal gauge theory has become a kind of harmonic oscillator of 4D gauge theory. I think its value is that it may be exactly solvable. We don't yet know for sure that it's exactly solvable, but at least there are indications, both from this dual ABS5 description and strong coupling, and from the presence of integrability at weak coupling, and it has been applied to a variety of systems, in particular to ion collisions, where it at least provides some useful qualitative information. But now, what we also know about quantum field theory in general is that it should also be useful in describing phase transitions in three-dimensional statistical systems. For example, the all-important water-vapor transition. You know, if you follow this critical line, well, if you follow the line of first-order transitions, you reach a critical point at this high temperature and pressure. And here, we know that this critical point is described by the three-dimensional easing model, where you think of the spin-up state as, say, water, and spin-down state as steam. So here, they become essentially indistinguishable. So this is another kind of wide range of applications of quantum field theory. It's not just useful for particle physics and four dimensions. It's also useful for statistical mechanics and three dimensions. And in this case, we expect to find some nice Euclidean QFT at some second order phase transitions. So generally, you would think that this is where ABS4 CFT3 duality can be very useful, because if some of these phase transitions have a dual ABS4 description, this could help matters. So this kind of naturally begs the question of, since we already know what is the harmonic oscillator of 4D conformal gauge theory, it's N=4 supernovae mills, one can ask, is there a similar sort of harmonic oscillator type of example for for 3D CFT that we can solve exactly in some limit? And here, I think historically, if you sort of poke around the literature, you basically, I think the natural example would be something like this, the ON three-dimensional sigma model, especially in the large N limit. This is an old model which definitely has applications to real world. It basically describes second-order phase transitions in materials, in systems which have some ON symmetry, like O2 and O3 examples are known. And it's described by this very simple Lagrangian. So you have, say, N scalar fields, and then you add a kind of double trace operator, which is pi squared all squared. This is, in the UV fixed point, a relevant operator, right? Because the field phi has dimension 1/2, so this operator has dimension 2, and it causes some RG flow from the trivial free fixed point to some non-trivial fixed point. This is the famous Wilson-Fisher fixed point, which can be studied in epsilon expansion, where epsilon is 4 minus b. And in three dimensions, of course, epsilon is equal to 1, so it's not guaranteed to be a good expansion, but it has been applied very successfully. And the nice thing about the large M limit of this model is that it becomes essentially exactly solvable. So the model in this large n limit simplifies because there is, just like in the free theory, in the directing theory, there is an infinite number of conserved currents. If you just write down these higher spin currents, like phi v, mu v, a bunch of derivatives phi, then they're exactly conserved up to 1 over n corrections. So in the large n limit, they're okay. And we know through the ADS-CFT dictionary that whenever there is a conserved current, there should be a dual gauge symmetry in the ball. So so the special feature of this theory, if it has an ADS dual, is that it should have an infinite number of higher spin gauge fields with spins going all the way to infinity. And it's sort of a long-standing problem that how to study these theories. They tend to be very complicated. But Frodkin and Vasiliev gave some arguments that when you put these theories in empty de Sitter space, they kind of simplify. So what Polyakov and I proposed a few years ago is that perhaps this this large N sigma model has some dual description in terms of this Frodkin-Vasiliev theory of an infinite number of interacting massless higher spin gauge fields. But here you encounter some major difficulty that while this theory is sort of abstractly known, it's extremely hard to make this concrete. And in particular, unlike the case of ADS-5-CFT-4, where there is a limit of small curvature, in this case, there is no small curvature limit. And the ADS curvature is, if you will, fixed at something, basically it's 1. And taking n to be large does not help to reduce the curvature. So it's some extremely complicated theory, and I think it's an interesting problem for the future to study this theory. But I think it's safe to say that in this example, the cure is kind of worse than the disease, because the CFT is fairly simple, but the dual ADS description is very complicated. But still, maybe provide some interesting qualitative insights, but I wouldn't say so far this ON sigma model, while it's a very nice model, it hasn't served as a golden example of ADS-4 CFT-3 duality. So this brings me to the main subject of my talk, which is M2 brain theory. So this has all the trappings of, I think it wants to be the golden example, in the sense that when n is large, it has a weakly curved dual ADS-4 cross the 7 description. But until recently, so it's something that is definitely possible to study semi-classically in the large n limit on the gravity side or on M-theory side. But the research was hampered by the fact that we didn't fully understand what that theory on N-coincident M2 brain is. And it should have the maximum possible n equal 8 supersymmetry in 3 dimensions. And there were even some kind of no-go theorems that the only theories with this amount of supersymmetry were just superangles theory. But this theorem was successfully challenged. Well, it wasn't really a theorem, but the kind of folk belief that was proven to be wrong by Bagger and Lambert, who actually successfully constructed the n equal 8 superconformal gauge theory. So let me just backtrack a little bit. So the status of this field, I think, until about a year ago was that one could extract all sorts of predictions from ADS-4 process 7. In particular, one could follow, you know, the gravity calculations and compute all sorts of things, but it wasn't totally clear what it is we're computing in terms of field theory. Right? And in particular, one very general fact about this particular ADS-4 CFT-3 duality for mental brains is that the number of degrees of freedom for n coincident and adaptive brain scales is n to the 3/2. This n to the 3/2 is essentially the overall factor which multiplies any correlation function of of local operators, it also multiplies the thermal free energy of the system. And this is quite different from what was going on for these three brains. There we just found the n squared both on gravity and on field theory side. Well, here this scaling is n to the 3 halves. And this is sort of one of the most general things, and it's still not well understood. And it's a puzzling sort of scaling, why n to the 3 halves. But at the same time, it sort of shows that because it's much smaller than n squared, you could imagine flowing to this sort of theory starting from a gauge theory, because gauge theory has sort of in the UV n squared degrees of freedom, and this should have n to the 3 halves. And now, so while we didn't fully understand what this theory is, it's already found a lot of qualitative applications to critical phenomena. Because there is a lot of sort of beautiful facts about this particular ABS4. For example, in particular, if you study black holes inside ABS4, because it's a four-dimensional space, they can carry both electric and magnetic charges, for example, and then there is some S duality interchanging electric and magnetic charge. So these systems have been provided a way of modeling various phenomena in condensed matter physics. For example, the people computed the Nernst coefficient, which was observed by Ohm's group from Princeton, in fact, these superconductors. There were these papers which basically give results in qualitative agreement with what the experimentalists find. No one knows why, because this. So all of this points to the need to understand precisely what the M2 brain theory is. It might incorporate some phenomena that are generic to three-dimensional CFTs, but we have to understand it. Okay, so are there any questions? Okay, so this brings me to the main question. So what is the M2 brain theory? So one general wisdom that has existed for many years, and which is still correct, is that it is the infrared limit of the D2 brain theory. Namely, if one considers the theory on D2 brains, so for any D brain theory, one finds supersymmetric Young-Mills theory. For DP brains, it lives in P+1 dimensions. So I already discussed what happens for P+3. That theory is exactly scale invariant. But it's certainly not true for, say, 2+1 dimensional D2 brain theory, because in that theory, the Young-Mills coupling has G Young-Mills squared has dimensions of energy. So if you go to very low energies, so there is an intrinsic scale set by G Young-Mills squared. And we can just study this theory with an energy much smaller than this energy scale G Young-Mills squared. And hopefully we find some scale invariant dynamics at these very low energies. So that is the general prescription for how you think about this theory. And then you would say that the ABS4 CFT3 duality predicts that the number of such degrees of freedom is n to the 3 halves. And it's good news that this is much smaller than the number of UV degrees of freedom, right? Because in this theory, which becomes very weakly coupled at high energies, at energies much bigger than Young-Mills squared n, there you certainly have n squared weakly coupled degrees of freedom. Then as you go to lower energies, the theory becomes strongly coupled and it should lose degrees of freedom. So it's not inconsistent then to see that there is a center of 3 halves, but we still don't know what it is. And this has always begged the question of, is there a more direct way to characterize this infrared scale invariant theory? I should say that, so this is clearly a hard problem in 2+1 dimensions. But this, if you ask the same question in 1+1 dimensions, this problem is exactly solvable. Because there, again, you can study what what happens. So in that case, GM Mills has dimensions of energy. And you can ask, what is the infrared CFT describing the energy scales much, much smaller than GM Mills? And that we can study exactly from the path integral and show that it's a given, it's given by a cross-set model, basically a WZW model. And we can calculate the central charge of the theory for. So this becomes interesting when we have, say, 2D and Mills coupled with some massless flavors transforming in some representation. So I think the dream here is to repeat in 2 plus 1 dimensions something that is clearly doable in 1 plus 1 dimensions and gives us a CFT, which with central charge we compute it, and we can compute its infrared dynamics. And I think this question has not been answered yet, precisely how to relate this description to what I'm about to say. But at least we have, based on the maximal supersymmetry, we have some other arguments to believe that we know the answer about a more direct characterization of these effective degrees of freedom at energies much, much smaller than GN squared. So, and the answer, of course, is the VLG theory, which evolved through many years of work by Geiger and Lambert, and also all parallel work by Gustafsson. And essentially, they formulated an SF4 trans-Simons gauge theory with manifest N equal 8 superconformal symmetry. Now, their formulation is involved something called free algebra, and I'm not a big expert on it, so I will not emphasize the free algebra aspects. I'm sure you have heard and will hear probably from me the discussion of this free algebra aspect. But what kind of really enticed me was seeing a paper by von Ramsdonk, who rewrote their theory just as a pretty conventional looking Charles-Simons theory with SU2 cross SU2 gauge. So I will basically restate this SU2 cross SU2 formulation and then discuss generalizations to higher number of rays. I should say that, okay, so when you formulated this SU2 cross SU2 gauge theory, then one finds 8 by fundamental fields transforming in 2,2 representations, right? And these are these X fields here. And you find, so in this rewriting, you have this perfectly explicit Lagrangian, and you see that the potential is sextic in these fields X. So these fields X are sort of the analogs of the fields phi that you see in the Nisri brain theory. Except for Nisri brain theory, we had this UN, SUN gauge group. And here, strangely enough, you have, say, SU2 cross SU2 or something like that. But you see that this potential here is again scale invariant because phi to the sixth potential in three dimensions is exactly scale invariant. But the main discovery of these people is that the gauge dynamics in this theory, you know, the main puzzle was that the gauge field itself, of course, cannot, the Young-Mills theory is not scale invariant. But we know that Charn-Simons theory is scale invariant. And they, essentially what you find is the following scale invariant term. So A is the, say, the gauge field of the first SU2, and A hat is that of the second SU2. 1 over F is essentially K, the Charn-Simons level, and what you see is this remarkable minus sign between the two. So the level of the first SU2 is, say, K, and the level of the second SU2 is minus. And this is quite important for realizing parity, because everyone thought that this theory has to be parity invariant, in particular the M2 brain theory was parity invariant. But here the parity is realized by interchanging the two gauge groups, in addition to parity for MK and minus K is something that goes into itself under this parity principle.
Sorry, so with this sign, it's the same thing, the transcendence plus the same thing as the first one gravity with the positive postmodern constant?
Yes, that also has two transcendence terms. Yes. In fact, I think the discovery, I don't know full history, but I think Jakeev, Templeton, and Besser maybe were the first to realize that there is a way to make Chern-Simons theory parity invariant by basically having two Chern-Simons terms with opposite levels and then the two terms. So indeed, this is true. And this is another interesting sort of connection. I was also told that these series with opposite Chern-Simons terms arise in condensed matter physics. For example, in Spitz-Spin's Hall effect, apparently they arise similar connections. Okay, so now each of these X fields satisfies a certain reality condition in this formulation, so that it has just four real degrees of freedom. It can be written in this form. The complex conjugate of X is minus epsilon X epsilon, where epsilon is this matrix. And you can also decompose each of these fields in terms of four X's with these sublabels, X4, X1, X2, and X3. And these form these transform into four of S of 4. So in the original Beger-Lambert-Gustafson formulation, they use this S of 4 formulation using these X fields, but we will find it useful to think of them as these 2x2 matrices with this reality condition. So the big breakthrough is that you see that in this theory, the SO8 symmetry, which rotates the 8 X fields, is manifest, right? There is a clear symmetry under this. And this is precisely the SO8 symmetry, which in ABS4 process 7 just rotates the 7th sphere. So it's the first example of such a theory. So this is nice. And when we saw this with my collaborators, my student, Dana, and BCTS postdoc Loza and another postdoc Smetak, we decided to try to rewrite this theory in n equal to superspace formulation. And then you, of course, in this formulation, you break some of the symmetry, right? So the corresponding formulation in, say, n equal to 4 super n mils, you only preserve say some U1R, and then you have some additional global symmetry which rotates these three complex fields. And here, you essentially group these X fields into four complex combinations, say X1 plus IX5, X2 plus IX6, and so on. And then you expect some SU4 flavor symmetry rotating these fields. Okay? So, and these are just the n equal 2 superfields in 2 plus 1 dimensions, which so here you have some these complex fields and associated formula. And then in this formulation, it's interesting that there is a rather simple superpotential, which is quartic in these complex fields. And to write it in the von Ramsdell's formulation, one needs this funny double dagger operation. This double dagger operation is basically explained here. What it means is that it's not the usual dagger, because the usual dagger will also send I to minus I. So this only acts on these two indices of these X fields. So in terms of these original X fields, you know exactly what X dagger is. Then you form the complex combinations, say X1 plus IX5, but you define Z double dagger as X1 dagger plus IX5 dagger instead of minus IX5 dagger. And so then armed with this operation, you basically can write down a nice superpotential, which among other things is explicitly symmetric under the SQ4 flavors. Okay, and this is the SQ4 flavor just acts on this overall label. So just to, this is one important point, that this is not the R symmetry. Right? The only R symmetry in this formulation is U1. The manifest R symmetry, then there is some other R symmetry, but this is just some global symmetry from this point of view. Yes.
So just so that in Z bar you've got a Z dagger. Is that a genuine dagger?
Yeah, this will be a genuine dagger.
So that'll change I to minus. It's the same as Z double except I is minus.
Right. But these are kind of anti-holomorphic. But this has, you see, the reason we couldn't write Z dagger here is because we think of Z dagger as anti-holomorphic. Okay, but the superpotential has to be pure holomorphic. But that's why we need this funny operation. And this operation, naively, it only exists for SQ2 group. Okay? You cannot define, because this reality condition that Van Ramsdell imposed, it relies on these being 2x2 matrices. There is no generalization. And this is, in a nutshell, why it's so hard to generalize this formulation to higher end. It's there for SQ2 cross SQ2, but it becomes difficult for higher groups. Okay, but here it's nice, and one can check. So one thing that we check is that starting with the superpotential, and there is also some intricate structure of heat terms, when you add everything up, you actually reproduce exactly this form of the potential. This form of potential is a subtle combination of F and D terms. There are some coming from the basically kinetic terms and some coming from this dWdz absolute value squared. They combine together to make something that's fully oscillate invariant. So while this formulation breaks the symmetry in the intermediate step, when you add everything up, you recover this fully symmetric BLG theory. So this is interesting. But now the question is, how do we generalize this to higher n? And as I mentioned, it's a highly non-trivial problem. It's extremely hard to preserve all symmetries. And in particular, so here comes sort of the next step, which is called the ABJM theory for Aronne, Bergman, Jaffers, and Moldesena, who made the following inspired suggestion, which is not entirely obvious when you think about this stuff. They proposed that the theory first of all, one statement they made is that the BLG theory, even for SU2 cross SU2 gauge group where it's known, is not exactly the theory on a pair of M2 brains. It's different in a subtle way from the theory of M2 brains. And in fact, the correct theory will involve a similar U2 cross U2 gauge theory. And then they proposed this U2 cross U2 gauge theory, and then they said that you can generalize this to UN cross UN, and this should describe N coincident M2 brain. But in doing this, they sacrificed something important. In particular, as I mentioned, that in this formulation, the symmetry, the SU4 flavor symmetry was still manifest, as is evident from this epsilon ABCD here. And this is just the symmetry. It's easy to see what the symmetry is. If you think about these four complex variables, it just rotates these four complex variables into each other. But now, in ABJM theory, they had to further break this flavor symmetry and only make SU2 cross SU2 manifest. And here is basically what they did for the case of two flavors. They basically defined, say, two variables. So now there are only two Zs, say Z1 and Z2, which are X1 plus IX5 and X2 plus IX6. But instead of writing, say, Z3 is equal to X3 plus IX7, instead write W1 is X3 dagger plus IX7 dagger. And W2 is X4 dagger plus IX8 dagger. And then, so this SU4 flavor is broken in this formulation to just SU2 plus SU2. So there is one SU2 rotating the Z's and another SU2 rotating the W's. And then there is a unique superpotential which respects this symmetry, which now you see has this epsilon AC and epsilon BD, and it has a structure ZW, ZW. Incidentally, this superpotential is exactly the same as for these regrains on the conifold, which is an interesting coincidence. But in that case, SU2 plus SU2 is the symmetry you want. Here, it's not really the symmetry you want. It's just some kind of intermediate step breaking the bigger symmetry. Okay, but now you see that these fields actually transform in different representations of the gauge group. While Z1 and Z2 are saying that by fundamentals, say fundamental with respect to this gauge group and anti-fundamental with respect to this one, the W's are opposite. So these are in the conjugate representations of the W. And this is possible thanks to just breaking this manifest symmetry. But then we can say, no problem, we can do the same for U3 plus U3 and U4 plus U4 and so on. So their suggestion for the theory on NM2 grains is just do this for UN plus UN and just adopt this N equal to superfield formulation and from there work out what the theory is. And they propose that this theory with Chern-Simons coefficients K and minus K for the two gauge groups are dual to ADS4 process 7 mod ZK, where ZK is a ZK orbital acting on ZK rotation of S7 and the simultaneous rotation of the 4 coordinates. So one interesting thing is that for k greater than 2, this theory has only n equals 6 manifest supersymmetry. And this actually is a symmetry which can be seen in the classical Lagrangian. This n equals 6 is manifested by the SU4 R symmetry. So I want to stress that this SU4 is not the same SU4 I was talking about in the BLG. And how do we see this SU4 R symmetry? Well, this SU4 R symmetry just rotates the Z's into W daggers, right? Because remember that the so in this BLG formulation, we have that the Z1 and Z2 fields under this UN cross UN. These are in the fundamental here and in the anti-fundamental here. But W1 and W2 are in the anti-fundamental here. Okay, so W dagger is in the same representation as the Z, right? So you could imagine a symmetry rotating Z1, Z2, W1 dagger, and W2 dagger into each other because they're in the same gauge group representation. And the amazing thing is that this symmetry is really there in the classic collection. Okay. And this is precisely the symmetry that is sort of unbroken by this orbifold. So if you look at this orbifold S7 mod ZK, it preserves this symmetry, and you basically see. But this, what I call the SU4 flavor symmetry, is broken by this orbifold in general. Okay, so if you just work out, again, it's a bit of an exercise to start from the superpotential and work out both the bosonic and fermionic terms in the action, they are once again a result of subtle combination between the D terms and the F terms. And then you find the result, which is manifestly symmetric under the SST4 symmetry. So this is a huge success of this ABGM formulation that you can see classically. But it doesn't give you manifestly n equal a supersymmetric theory. It only gives you manifest n equals c. So this still, while the BLG theory was manifestly n equal a supersymmetric. So one thing that has to happen in this ABGM theory is that when you reduce the level to 1, so when k is 1, then the zk is trivial, and you should recover ABS4 process steps. So you should just recover M2 brains without any waterfall, but just in flat space. And this is somehow the major difficulty in ABGM theory, how to recover this. So this is brings me to the next transparency, which is how do we see this enhanced symmetry? So for k equal 1 or 2, this global symmetry should enhance to SO8, according to this conjecture. And this symmetry is just not classically obvious. So it should be somehow emerge only at the quantum level. This is not too surprising because for large k, the theory is semi-classical and weakly coupled. But for k equal, for small k, it's strongly coupled. So there could be some very strong quantum effects which enhance the symmetry. And what basically all the experts on the subject say is, so what's going to fix this? Well, we need to study so-called monopole operators, also called the disorder operators, that create just some singular monopole field configurations of these gauge fields. And these monopole operators should somehow provide you some additional ingredients that fix this. So in a nutshell, here is what's the difficulty. That if you just formulate this theory, in four dimensions, we knew that the only fields which transform under this, say, UN cross U engaged groups were just these Z's and W's, right? So these Z's have some indices. Nothing else has these indices. So you just are supposed to make composite operators contracting Z's and W's in the gauge invariant way, and that was that. But somehow in this theory, there should be additional operators just from the gauge field sector, essentially, which also carry indices and play a very important role. So this is essentially the question. And the question is, so how do we study these monopole operators? Well, these operators create some magnetic flux in the diagonal U1 subgroup. If you think about this theory is SUN cross SUN cross U1 cross U1, there is, you can write that particular part of the action as follows. You can write that this K over 4 pi integral V3x epsilon U nu lambda, then there is say V nu C lambda. And C is basically the gauge field corresponding to diagonal U1, and V mu is for anti-diagonal U1. So it turns out that under this diagonal U1, nothing is charged. So this is a completely neutral field. And then what should happen is we should be able to quantize the field strength. So when you study this theory on the two-sphere, the flux of this field came with the integral of F2, where F is dc, the integral of F2 is quantized. So you when you study the sphere and the two-sphere, which is what you do in ABS-CFT, you have to quantize the flux of this neutral field, and these non-trivial sectors are precisely these monopoles. So you just basically study it in this monopole. In this uniform field background on the two sphere. So it's as if you're studying the theory on the two sphere with a magnetic monopole at the center of this two sphere. So this is essentially the hard part of this, is how to study it with this extra magnetic flux. But these extra sectors is what provides some missing operators, which are naively absent. So we had some comments on these operators in a recent paper with Loza and my other graduate student, Murugan. Essentially, you can say the following, that singly charged operator means that you're just putting one unit of flux at the center of this two sphere. And one can show that this single monopole operator transforms as, say, fundamental under SQN and anti-fundamental under the other SQN. So you see that once you put in this flux, these operators acquire some gauge transformation property. So they're a bit like these Z's and W's, and you can contract them with Z's and W's to form new gauge invariant operators. And then you can consider, for example, doubly charged operators, which now have two indices in one SQN and two indices in the other SQN, and so on, and up to infinity. So this is essentially the whole crux of how you might be able to see this enhanced symmetry for capable ones. So how could it go? So this is the kind of speculative part of the talk. One could imagine the following construction of this SU4 flavor. You see that the W, W1 cannot be a partner of Z1 because they have different index positions, right? If you look at Z, Z has S positions, say, A hat, but W has positions A hat, A, right? But if you multiply the W by this monopole operator, doubly charged monopole operator, it puts the indices in the same position as the Z. So you could imagine these fields, say Z1, Z2, W1 e to the 2 tau, and W2 e to the 2 tau, as forming a multiplet of a certain SQ4 symmetry. Now, I want to stress that this is not the symmetry which is SU4R, because that we already saw classically. It's some other SU4. And once we see this SU4, so this SU4 only exists for k equal 1 or 2. Okay, because starting with k equal 3, even the singly charged monopole operator will have three indices. So it has too many indices for this to make sense. So it's a highly quantum symmetry that only appears for k equal 1 and k equal 2. And here we basically show how these indices are contracted. But how do we know that this makes some sense? Well, we tried to work out just the simplest case of U2 cross U2 theory, which is almost the same as the DLG theory, but slightly different. And here is what we know, is that if you assume that e to the two tau, you still have to provide some information about the index structure of these A and B. And if you just assume that the index structure of these operators is epsilon, because for SU2 there are these invariant epsilon, times an operator T that creates that carries some charge under this. So this one is called the baryonic symmetry. This is people call it baryonic symmetry. And just from this coupling, you see, once you put the flux into B mu C, you see that there will be a source for B mu. So these monopole operators definitely carry some baryonic charge. So if you just say that this, so you know that these operators have to have some baryonic charge, but you can kind of separate the baryonic charge from the indices from the SQN n part. So if you say that there is some operator T, which is a purely abelian monopole operator in this U1 cross U1 theory, which carries the right baryonic charge, then this seems to solve all the problems. Namely, for this particular case, this ansatz indeed shows that this, the theory reduces to, that the theory has this SQ4 flavor symmetry. And the reason you see it is that then the superpotential is almost the same as in the BLG theory. It's, again, this epsilon ABCD, trace EZ, double dagger. But there is just an overall T to the minus 4, which restores the right U1B charge. So let me say it again. I mean, the problem with saying that the BLG theory is the right theory is because when you write something like this, it still carries this U1B charge. So it's not fully gauge invariant under U2 cross T2. But if you just multiply it by this operator T, which only carries this charge, then this is fully gauge invariant and SQ4 flavor symmetry. So this appears to accomplish what we wanted. It wants to basically restore this SQ4 flavor symmetry only for K1 and K2. But so far, we're only claiming success in the original case of 2M2 grains. And we don't know how to make this explicit for the case of higher number of grains. Okay, so now this is the final part of the talk, which is that then one can, so basically this N equals 6 supersymmetric theory is nice and has already been subjected to various tests. But we also want to study theories with less supersymmetry, which somehow break the supersymmetry. And one trick towards doing this is simply take this M2 brain theory, like say ADJM theory, and perturb it by some relevant operator that causes RG flow to a new fixed point. And one particular thing that one can do, say, suppose you want to preserve SQ3 flavor symmetry. Well, one can just take and a quadratic term in the superpotential for just the field Z4. Okay, so Z4, Z4 times this monopole operator e to the minus 2 tau. Clearly, this preserves the SQ3 that rotates the Z1, Z2, and Z3. And it's a relevant operator. You also see is that it's only allowed once again for K1 and 2 and does not make sense for higher K. Because for higher K, the number of indices here grows with K, and you can not write down something like that. So this becomes, for this, you say U2 cross T2 case, we can make it explicit and write this again as T minus 2 trace Z4, Z4 double dagger. And then you can understand the infrared superconformal field theory by just integrating out Z4 in favor of other Zs, and you obtain the effective superpotential, which is now sextic in Zs. Sextic in Zs. And that means that the R charge, the total R charge still has to be 2. So the R charge of each Z has to be 2 sixths or 1/3. So it's some rather new theory with sextic superpotential, but it still manages to be somehow an angle to supersymmetric. That's the proposal. But now the main question is, what is this dual? I mean, so we find some proposed theory with SU3 flavor symmetry and N equal to supersymmetry. And what is the dual ADS4 background in MTU? And then pondering this question, I one day remembered that there was such an extremum of gauge supergravity, which was found really long, long ago, something like 83, just the beginning. It's even before people did a lot of this ADS-5 stuff. They were very interested in 82 and 83 and ADS-4 backgrounds because they thought that this was the real world. They wanted to study gauge supergravities. And they found so when you study the extremum of the potential of gauge supergravity, besides the basic one with SO8 symmetry, there was one with SU3 plus Q1 symmetry. Werner found it long ago. And then in some later work, they managed to uplift it to 11 dimensions and construct. It's actually quite a complicated solution. It's not like ADS-4 cross squashed 7 sphere. It actually has some extra warp factor in front of ADS-4. And so this is basically our proposal that this background of M theory is dual to this theory with this sextic superpotential and SU3 plus U1, of course. How can we check this proposal? Well, this is something we tried to do in our last paper. Namely, we tried to study just the spectrum of short multiplets. For example, there are these short hypermultiplets whose SU3 representations are, you know, the SU3 notation is P comma Q, and you have, say, N plus 2 comma 0 with a certain R charge. And this is determined just from analyzing the spectrum of gauge supergravity. And you see that these characteristic R charges, which are multiples of 1/3, this is exactly what you need to match the field theory. Because in field theory, you had these 1/3 for each Z. In field theory, the proposal was that each Z carries R charge 1/3, the fermion then carries minus 2/3. R charge. And these hypermultiplets are the most basic operators. They are just symmetric polynomials in Z, right? So very naively, you would just write symmetric SU3 polynomial, which corresponds to indeed the Young tableau, which with. So for example, the lowest operator you can have will be just something like trace Z A Z, right? And this is symmetric, but corresponds to the 6 of SQ3. This Young tableau, this is 6 of SQ3, SQ3 flavor, and it carries R charge, which is 2/3. R is equal. And amazingly enough, there is such a field in this spherical harmonic analysis. Although I have to say that the way this, because this background is so complicated, this whole construction was carried out not through direct analysis of spherical harmonics, but just through analyzing group theory for this, which was tried long ago by Nikolai and Werner, and we were just following what they did. But anyways, if you just look, say, at these hypermultiplets, which are just polynomials in Z's, you see that there is matching, okay? And the explicit form of these operators, say, for U2 cross Q2, can again be written down involving these Z's and Z double daggers. And operators with odd number of fields always require a monopole operator. This was the case even for ABJM theory. Even for ABJM theory to write odd operators, you need these monopole operators. So this is good news, but I'm still not entirely happy with understanding of the supergravity side. So we're now trying to understand better the analysis of spherical harmonics and just get maybe a better understanding of these quantum numbers. But at least I think so far this proposal has passed some neat checks. Okay, are there any questions? I think these are checks on the same level as, say, in ABJM theory, right? You can write down some polynomials in these A and B fields and match that with a 7 multi K or before. Okay, so what are the further directions? I mean, there are lots of them. There are many groups that are investigating other examples of AGS4 CFT3 dualities based on this with various degrees of supersymmetry. I should apologize that these ends somehow on my computer, they were curly ends, but this curliness was lost in translation. So it's not just me being sloppy, but. Okay, so the ultimate physics goal, I think, from the point of view of the applications to statistical systems that I mentioned before, would be to try to find some simple dual of a really non-trivial 3D fixed point, which is somehow realized in, I don't know, quantum spin, Hall effect, or something like that. So far we don't have it, but we do have some not very non-trivial looking duality here in this case. So there is hope that this M2 brain stuff will somehow actually connect to physics. I mean, the analogous story for D3 brains is that we get the N equal 4 supernose theory, and which is not QCD, right? We know it's not QCD, but still we try to apply it to the physics of QCD at high temperature or something like that. Still, one always has to keep in mind that it's not QCD. I think here there is hope that there will be really big duality with something that's that's realizable in age. So that's a kind of good goal. And so in this wave of M2 papers, a couple of months ago, I got very excited because I thought that a real connection to, I have a PH paper which said, whose title was M2 Signatures and Psi to S Radiated Decays. So I thought, gosh, this is really it. But then I realized that it's not quite there yet, but it's a different M2, but
probably magnetic particles.
Absolutely. You got it. So false alarm, but I think it's still this goal, I think, is a good thing to keep in mind. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for the speaker? Well, that's good. Thank you again.